In this video, I want to talk about the difference between supporting dictators for the purposes of realpolitik and supporting them because you agree with their ideological beliefs. First, what is realpolitik? It's a term we typically associate with the political thought of Niccolo Machiavelli. To explain this very quickly, before the 1520s, which is when Machiavelli was writing, there had been a long tradition of writing advices to princes. The advice dispensed in these old manuals tended to stress how good Christian kings should lead by example and be kind and virtuous. In The Prince, Machiavelli pointed out that this is all nice in theory, but in practice a good Christian king would more than likely find themselves dead. In the real world, people are out for their own interests, and all it would take is for one scheming courtier to stab you in the back, and you'd lose the throne. In a world where people are ruthless and cunning, you need to be more ruthless or more cunning. So, realpolitik sets aside ideological or moral considerations and concerns itself only with the practicalities of what needs to be done. It is a form of pragmatism. Machiavelli discourages idealism of any sort. You cannot trust anyone fully. If someone can screw you over, if it's truly in their best interests, they probably will. If someone stands to gain by your fall, they will probably let you fall, and so on and so forth. In The Prince, Machiavelli chiefly focuses on what individual rulers need to do in order to secure their power, especially when they are occupying a newly conquered nation. It's not all grim trickery or evil, as his reputation suggests, but simply whatever will get the job done. Some situations require a soft touch, others a firm hand. In a characteristic passage, he writes, "And here comes in the question whether it is better to be loved than feared, or feared rather than loved. It might perhaps be answered that we should wish to be both, but since love and fear can hardly exist together, if we must choose between them, it is far safer to be feared than loved. For of men, it may generally be affirmed that they are thankless, fickle, false, studious to avoid danger, greedy of gain, devoted to you while you are able to confer benefits upon them, and ready, as I said before, while danger is distant, to shed their blood and sacrifice their property, their lives, and their children for you. But in the hour of need they turn against you. The prince, therefore, who, without otherwise securing himself, builds wholly on their professions, is undone. For the friendships which we buy with a price, and do not gain by greatness and nobility of character, though they be fairly earned, are not made good, but fail us when we have occasion to use them. Moreover, men are less careful how they offend him who makes himself loved than him who makes himself feared. For love is held by the tie of obligation, which, because men are a sorry breed, is broken on every whisper of private interest. But fear is bound by the apprehension of punishment, which never relaxes its grasp." I want to fast forward now to more recent times and to consider not individuals but nation-states. Just as individuals are self-interested agents, so too are nation-states by definition for their own benefits. This makes the relationship between nations in geopolitics somewhat like the relationship between members of the prince's court. And just like the court, not all agents are equal in power. In the 19th century, the superpower in global politics was the United Kingdom. As the cliché goes, the sun never set on the British Empire. Because of this, the British had interests all around the globe, and British foreign policy reflected those interests. The so-called Great Game, for example, a protracted game of chess with the Russians over Afghanistan, where Britain's real goal was to keep a buffer between the Russians and its prized territory in India. Meanwhile, the Russians' real goal was to control the Sultan of Turkey to block the traditional access route into Russia through the Strait of Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul. Fast forward another 100 years or so, and the Russians were involved in another great game, the Cold War. This time, the rival superpower was the United States. After the Second World War, it was no longer de rigueur to think in terms of formal empires. Instead, they thought in terms of spheres of influence and alliances. For all intents and purposes, the NATO countries formed one bloc and the Warsaw Pact countries formed another. And then outside of that, it was fair game to flip countries red or blue. When people think about the USA supporting various dictators in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, they should remember that it was almost exclusively in this context of flipping them blue from red. So when, for example, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger gave the go-ahead to back the CIA to lead a coup against the socialist Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973, it was because Nixon feared Chile becoming another Cuba, which of course had fallen under Soviet influence when Fidel Castro successfully led a revolution in 1959. And of course, the USSR promptly installed nuclear warheads on the island just off the foot of Florida. Castro's explicit aim was to export communism to other South American countries and even into Africa. He funded insurgencies around the world. The revolutionary career of that pinup of leftist twats everywhere, Che Guevara, is especially instructive when it comes to this. Now, of course, virtue-signalling idiots are very quick to condemn Kissinger or Nixon for their interventions, but they never bother to point out that under Stalin, Khrushchev and then Brezhnev, the USSR funded all manner of mischief in South America and in Africa. Lots of countries during this period were decolonizing as the last remnants of the British Empire died out, and other European countries like France and Belgium were losing their colonies also. The Congo, for example, gained independence in 1960 and almost immediately became a battleground territory between the Americans and the Soviets. A similar story in Zimbabwe, where the Soviets and, of course, Fidel Castro supported Robert Mugabe's ZANU insurgency in the 1960s when the British granted independence to Rhodesia. So, with all of these different places, the key question is, do they flip red or do they flip blue? Let's take Iraq as a good example. In 1968, the Arab Socialist Baathist Party under Ahmed Hassan al-Bakir led a coup to overthrow the old Iraqi Republic. They needed a strong trading partner to whom they could sell their oil. Remember, the Russians had been playing the great game in the Middle East since at least 1818, so it was important to them to have an ally on their border. Even before the overthrow of the Republic, Iraq and the Soviet Union had signed an agreement whereby Iraq would supply the nation with oil in exchange for large-scale access to Eastern Bloc arms. Under al-Bakr, they signed a treaty of friendship and cooperation. And this was strategically excellent for both parties. To Iraq's east was Iran, which was, up until 1979, under the Shah and very friendly to the west. So Iraq was a nice counterweight for the Soviets to Western and Iranian power. But in 1979, two key things happened. First, Saddam Hussein, who had been a general in al-Bakir's army, rose to power by forcing the now elderly leader to resign. And in Iran, the Shah was violently overthrown by popular revolution led by the Ayatollah Khomeini, which established the Islamic regime that is still there now. Khomeini was fiercely anti-American and anti-Western, famously calling the Americans the Great Satan. The Iran hostage crisis spelt the end for Jimmy Carter. So now, the USA was faced with the prospect of a completely anti-Western Middle East. The Soviets, meanwhile, were of course sitting pretty, but Saddam feared that the new fervor in Iran would stir up Shiite sentiments in Iraq, and he also harbored ambitions to supplant Iran as the key regional power. So, in 1980, he did something truly insane. He invaded Iran. Absolutely bonkers, and it led to an 8-year conflict which was essentially static World War I-style trench warfare. This was naturally a disaster for the Soviets, since it had hoped to gain Iran as a new ally while retaining its old strategic partner to achieve hegemony in the region. It wasn't particularly great news for the USA either, because it could not afford for its new enemy, Iran, to take over Iraq and become even more powerful. And it was somewhat hamstrung in helping Iraq too because of the aforementioned long-standing Soviet connection. The USSR declared itself neutral. The USA, still somewhat reeling from the Iran hostage crisis and losing its key ally in the region, also officially declared itself neutral. However, the Soviet Union, in a replay of long-standing Russian ambitions reminiscent of the Great Game, had invaded Afghanistan in December 1979, and Saddam openly condemned this act of aggression. This led to relations between Iraq and the USSR being at a low ebb and opened the door to Washington speaking to the Iraqis again, and now they had an urgent reason to do so. So now you had a situation pretty late on in the Cold War where two countries were actually at war and both of the superpowers were supposedly neutral. But of course, they weren't really neutral. Neither the USA nor the USSR could afford there to be a decisive victory in the war, because the costs of one of them flipping red or blue in the aftermath would be too great. By 1982, Iran was winning the war decisively, and Saddam's forces were getting wrecked. Khomeini vowed to press all the way to Baghdad in order to overthrow him. At this moment, both the Americans and the Soviets intervened to supply the Iraqis with more weapons. The Soviets, whose friendly overtures had already been rebuffed by Khomeini once, feared the spread of radical Islam in the region. The Americans, meanwhile, feared that Khomeini wouldn't stop in Baghdad, but would advance further to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, now their key suppliers of oil. And so Saddam was rearmed, enough to drive the war into a stalemate. But the Soviets were giving Saddam ridiculous amounts of weapons, tanks, missiles, over $9.2 billion worth, in fact. And of course, the Americans couldn't afford to have the Iraqis win the war either. And so, during the much-publicised Iran-Contra affair, a major scandal for Ronald Reagan, they secretly sold Iran about 3,000 anti-tank missiles. At the same time, you had the completely insane situation of Israel, yes, Israel, supplying Iran with weapons and ammunition in exchange for oil. If this seems completely baffling to us now, remember that Israel had had relatively good relations with the Shah, and they hoped to maintain at least some influence with the new regime. It seems that no one quite realised quite how radical the Ayatollah was. And to this day, the Iranian revolutionary leaders deny these trades with Israel ever happened, even though there are pictures of the stuff they bought being used in action. So anyway, I hope you can see by this point where this is going. The world of geopolitics is pure realpolitik, so many considerations are purely strategic. Morality simply does not come into it. It's Machiavelli through and through. Leaders come and go, situations change, power shifts, but the geopolitical concerns do not change drastically. Even today, in 2017, the regional politics of the Middle East echo the great game of the 19th century. The players have changed, but the game has stayed the same. It's so hard to escape the gunfire. I wish I could rule it out like an umpire. But it's an everlasting game and it never ceases to exist. Only the players change. Now today, the USA has military bases in Afghanistan and Iraq after full-scale invasions by George W. Bush into those countries. And Russia under Vladimir Putin counts Iran as a key strategic ally, both in terms of military support against ISIS in Syria and in terms of resources. This is the real world. This is realpolitik. And you have to take a dispassionate view because the strategic considerations are what they are. Countries will always look out for their own interests when push comes to shove. Now you could say, well yes, but why didn't the USA keep their noses out of the affairs of other nations? But all that happens in that scenario is that you either let the Russian power go unchecked or you let some other power go unchecked. Take the Iran-Iraq War. If the USSR and the USA had not intervened in 1982, Khomeini would probably have expanded to the limits of the old Persian Empire, in many ways the natural regional superpower, or at least it had, was for the vast expanse of history. From the Iranian point of view, that's excellent, it's what they want. But from the point of view of any country which is not so keen on their particular brand of Islamic theocracy, it's not so great. Neville Chamberlain will always rank among the worst ever British Prime Ministers because he sided with the pacifists in the 1930s and failed to check Hitler's expansions in Europe. When the British finally went to war with the Germans, Hitler was much stronger than he would have been if his wings had been clipped earlier. There are very sound reasons to maintain the balance of power. But ah, yes, you might say, it's not balanced, is it? Because there's a superpower in play. To which I would say, but yes, they are on our side. If it's not them, it'll be some other power. The Russians, the Chinese, whoever. God help us, maybe even the Germans. There will always be some party who holds the whip hand. And thank your stars, it's one of our own. So what's the difference between all of that and Jeremy Corbyn saying things like Fidel Castro is a champion of social justice? Or what about when George Galloway goes and meets Saddam Hussein just 3 years after the first Gulf War? Or what about when Bernie Sanders praises Venezuela unironically? What's the difference? None of these men were in power when they said these things. They, somewhat incredibly, were actually using these dictators as an anti-Western virtue signal. Do you see how that is absolutely nothing, like Nixon strategically needing to back Pinochet or Ronald Reagan needing to play off both of the sides in the Iran-Iraq war? One is to achieve a specific geopolitical end in the national interest, the other is literally siding against your own country with an enemy state because you agree with the policies of the dictator. The left does not and never can play whataboutery on this issue. It's shameful that they even try. But it's hardly surprising because, of course, they only think about things on an emotional level. They see harm, they see people being killed, and they want someone to blame so they can feel better about it. When you base your entire political identity on the lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, that's what you end up with. Judging the real world against the make-believe standards of no religion, no countries, no possessions, no causes to kill or die for, a brotherhood of man sharing all the world. When are you going to grow up and realise that it's just a stupid song? More deluded even than the writers of the Advices to Princes before Machiavelli.